Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How many times I gotta say this? Without the American consumer, this economy is no place. Springtime is upon us, and so clearly is shopping season. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It's the 14th of April today, and I will tell you what. Thank goodness for you. That's it. That's the message today, the sum and total of the statistically relevant business and economic news. The phrase you're looking for here, everybody, is pent-up demand, because after a long, cold winter of many discontents, the Commerce Department told us this morning March retail sales were up 1.1% from the previous month, almost 4% higher than a year ago. Turns out that after being trapped inside, we are out there buying up almost anything we can get our hands on. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman hit the streets of Portland, Oregon today to find out more.
I headed out to Nordstrom in downtown Portland, Oregon, where I met Deborah Trout Kolb. She was visiting from Connecticut, where she hadn't shopped that much all winter, in part, she says, because the weather was
horrendously awful, yeah.
Trout Kolb owns a fitness studio, and her income fell.
Obviously, if people can't come into a dance and fitness studio, they don't pay. But yes, I believe it's getting better.
And is that making you feel any bit more like spending?
Yes, definitely. You got to do that retail therapy every once in a while.
And this, writ large, is the retail story for the whole country. People who didn't shop for clothes or washing machines or cars in midwinter have come into stores with a vengeance. Though there are still some headwinds, especially at the bottom of the income ladder, says economist Chris Christopher at IHS Global Insight.
Extended unemployment benefits being phased out, in addition to food stamps lowered.
And for the middle class, income and household wealth still haven't caught up to pre-recession levels. So what's fueling these rising retail sales? NYU economist Edward Wolfe.
Rising debt levels, consumer debt particularly, which is helping to increase consumer spending, retail sales.
Some of that consumer borrowing is driven by people feeling wealthier, if their house or stock portfolio has risen in value. And some of it's just that need for retail therapy that the shopper heading into the department store was talking about. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
With apologies to REM, this today from the Marketplace desk of the end of the world as we know it, and it's definitely not fine. The latest United Nations climate change report says that if we don't do some really tough and really expensive things over the next 15 years, the costs of climate change will likely spiral out of control. Scientists have been telling us we have to do these things for decades now, and yet we are still holding back. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more on the behavioral economics of a warming planet.
On an individual level, it turns out there are lots of things holding us back. Robert Gifford is a psychologist at the University of Victoria. He's identified what he calls the dragons of inaction on climate change. So far, he says he's counted more than 30. Here's one from his top 10.
Lack of perceived behavioral control, which in plain English is, what can I do about it? I'm only one person out of 7.5 billion people.
Another one is fatalism.
If people think the game is already over, then why should I do anything?
Anthony Leisowitz runs the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication.
I call this the policy problem from hell, because you almost couldn't design a problem that in some ways is a worse fit with our underlying psychology as well as our institutional decision-making.
Psychologically, he says it doesn't help that carbon dioxide itself is invisible, hard to fight what you can't see. And even if you know climate change is real, it often seems too far away to focus on.
Many people still think it's distant in time, that the impacts won't be felt for a generation or more, and distant in space, that this is about polar bears.
And then, as Leisowitz notes, there are those institutional structures. David Victor is the author of Global Warming Gridlock. He put together the introductory chapter of that new UN report.
What makes this even harder is that countries need to coordinate. No big emitter is going to control its emissions aggressively and bear that cost unless it sees other major emitters in the world doing something similar.
The UN climate report outlines steps to hold global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. Victor says he expects the world to blow past that target. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Wall Street at the finish today, better than where it started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the full knowledge that a lot of you are scrambling today to get your taxes done by tomorrow, we will take this moment to perhaps lessen your stress level. Your odds of getting audited are about as low as they've ever been. Budget cuts and basically a whole bunch of other stuff they've got to do have cut into the IRS's enforcement budget. They'll audit just 0.88% of returns for people making under $200,000 a year. But with $300 billion in uncollected taxes on the line, the IRS is not about to give up. So enter the robots, because the tax man might not have a whole lot of manpower, but it does have a whole lot of data on you. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
If you've ever watched a gangster movie or been a gangster, you know that you have to be careful about spending your ill-gotten gains. Consider this advice, given by lawyer Saul Goodman to his meth kingpin client, Jesse Pinkman, in Breaking Bad.
It's the tax man, and he's looking at you. He sees a young fella with a big fancy house, unlimited cash supply, and no job. Now, what is the conclusion the tax man makes?
I'm a drug dealer.
Wrong. Million times worse. You're a tax cheat. If they can get Capone, they can get you.
And these days, the tax man has a whole new way to track your wild spending. Namely, you.
It's hard to believe that anybody who puts anything on Facebook has any legitimate expectation of privacy.
Edward Zielinski is a professor of tax law at Yeshiva University. He says those fancy vacation photos you posted on Instagram, the Facebook status update about your new car, the tweets about your wildly successful side business, all fair game for the IRS.
And the IRS says you didn't report any income last year, but you're telling everybody about how you took your girlfriend to a Rio de Janeiro for the weekend. I think that's a very legitimate use of the modern technology.
Not that the IRS is perusing everyone's Facebook photos. It's probably only looking at your Facebook photos if it suspects you might be a tax dodger. How does it get suspicious? Data, of course. Benham Dayanim chairs the privacy and data practice at Paul Hastings.
It appears from its public statements and some of the other reports that it's using data to piece together profiles or likely candidates for closer review.
The IRS is notoriously secretive about its methods. It didn't respond to repeated requests for comment. But recent private sector hires and off-the-record sources indicate the IRS is seriously gearing up its data mining, using tools like online activity trackers to enhance the vast cache of information it's already privy to, namely your Social Security number, your health records, your banking transactions. The result? A pretty sophisticated data profile.
It seems that they may be using predictive analytics.
Joseph Turo is a data expert at the University of Pennsylvania.
Which takes a huge amount of data and puts it together in a big pot to see if they can predict which individuals don't pay their taxes.
And creating profiles based on that data could be problematic, says Turo.
Once you begin giving people scores like that, you've given them reputations that might stay with them over years and might be used by the IRS and other agencies in really incorrect ways.
Of course, these days, everyone from Google to Nike is cobbling our data together to create profiles of us. Still, it's different when the IRS does it, says Benham Dayanim.
If Nike is analyzing my information, the worst consequence is that they market stuff to me that I don't want, and it's annoying. If the government does it, the worst consequence is that there could be legal ramifications, right? Whether it's fines, penalties, or imprisonment.
If you don't want the IRS in your online business, Dayanim suggests ratcheting up the privacy settings on all of your social media accounts and never posting anything you wouldn't want the agency to see. You could also try a charm offensive. The IRS has 24,000 Facebook fans and 52,000 Twitter followers. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I grant you this may not be top of mind if you still haven't finished your taxes, but Stacey put together a handy little list of how to avoid being tracked online. Some of them are pretty obvious, some of them not so much. Marketplace.org, you can read them there. Maxwell House Coffee got a makeover today. Parent company Kraft rolled out a whole new logo, some new packaging, and a new ad campaign as well. Maxwell House is still good to the last drop, of course, but also apparently it's a reason to say good morning to a good day. Kraft is also going to be refreshing some of its other old brands like Kraft Cheeses and Cool Whip, too. Sally Herships has more on what happens when you tinker with a classic brand's brand.
An idea that might have seemed great a few decades ago, I'm talking about Quaker Oats' old version of Aunt Jemima, might not seem so hot just a little bit later. So how should a brand handle this kind of big change?
In general, what it is that you want to do is be very, very, very consistent with your brand.
Dave Riebstein teaches marketing at Wharton. He says if and when big brands like Maxwell House Coffee update their identities, they need to keep it simple to avoid the worst-case scenario.
I walk down the aisle, I don't even see it.
Tom Mavis teaches marketing at NYU Stern School of Business. He says Brawny Paper Towels had an image problem with its illustrated spokesman.
The Wall Street Journal describes him as a 70s porn star.
A big mustache and neck hair. But Mavis says that brand handled its image right, with baby steps. It slowly shrank the problem mustache and character until they were replaced by one who was a little more up-to-date. But makeovers can be tricky, especially for old brands like Maxwell House.
The problem is that, you know, if your product has stalled somewhat, a subtle change may not be enough.
Matt Egan is with Siegel & Gale, a brand consultancy based in New York. He says even though Kraft says its coffee has a brand new campaign, not enough is new.
Here's our coffee. It is good. And drink it.
Egan says especially for a part of the market that's not growing, coffee cans on supermarket shelves, the updated look may be too simple. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Before we go on, a follow-up to our story Friday about the origins of the Choose Your Own Adventure book series. Pretty cool little story if you missed it, by the way. People wrote in with a lot of childhood memories, and we got a response from a small publishing company in Vermont called Choose Co., which bought the series after Bantam dropped it, which is to say you can still go out there and choose your own adventure books. You can hear our piece at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Can you imagine deciding that we're going to send 12 people to the surface of the moon and that it's going to cost 4% of the national budget and 2% of the national workforce for a decade?
Well, when you put it that way, marketing the moon straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Some good retail news and a positive report from the country's third biggest bank gave stocks a boost today. The Dow Industrials hopped up 146 points. That's 0.9% on the blue chips. Closed at 16,173. The NASDAQ lifted 22 points, about 0.5%. Ended things at 4,022. The S&P 500 hiked 14 points higher, 0.8%. Ended things at 1830. Citigroup charged up 2% today after it released some good quarterly numbers. Morgan Stanley also jumped 2%. B of A, Bank of America, up 1.5%. Retailers generally did better on the back of that report, showing consumer spending more last month. Target lifted 0.9%. Walmart jumped more than 1% as well. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. Did consumers pay more or less for stuff in March than they did in February? The Labor Department issues its Consumer Price Index. And here's some news with teeth. A ceremony at the Smithsonian's Natural History Museum marks the arrival of a nearly complete Tyrannosaurus Rex fossil. I see a future of selfies with T-Rex. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's enough life in the American real estate market now that flipping is a thing again. Speculators, or if you prefer, investors, buying houses, fixing them up, and selling them off, even in places that have been passed over by the real big money. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports now from just outside Washington, D.C.
Prince George's County doesn't have the glitzy condos of Miami Beach or new housing developments of Vegas that the big investors like, but it does have lots of housing for middle and low-income families. I'm walking up a sidewalk in Prince George's County to meet Rich Miner at his latest acquisition, a house in Bowie, Maryland. He shows me in. Miner says the former owner lived here for 22 years and left behind a lot of stuff.
But this is fairly typical.
Minor didn't want to say what he paid for the house, but according to public records, it sold for $195,000. As he shows me around, Minor explains he laid low during the housing crisis, but he was one of the first flippers to come back to Prince George's County in 2009 when you could buy foreclosures cheap. Now there's actually a lot of competition since flipping is back.
It's back. And it's back with a vengeance now because, like I said, the deals are much harder to come by.
And even if you get a deal in Prince George's County, it may be in a neighborhood like this one in New Carrollton, Maryland. It's a little dilapidated. And it's where I meet Anthony Sanders, who teaches real estate finance at George Mason University. As we stand in the driveway of a foreclosed home, he surveys the scene.
Sure. If you look around this neighborhood, every single house in this neighborhood has a very old roof that's in need of repair, which is generally a bad sign for a neighborhood.
Sanders points to a fence around one house. There are holes along the bottom. Sanders says it looks like somebody tried to break in. Behind the fence, a barking dog that looks very much like a pit bull. Lucky for us, it can't get out. Sanders says this is not the kind of neighborhood that attracts the big foreign investors and hedge funds.
Yeah, we're not getting the big boys here. We're getting the small fries.
Small fry flippers who know they're going to spend a lot to fix these houses up and can't sell them for too much because they're still not in great neighborhoods. But that doesn't mean there isn't a lot of competition for fixer-uppers, even in rough areas.
We renovate and sell our single-family homes.
That's Mary Ann Dillon, who heads the Housing Initiative Partnership, a nonprofit that buys rundown houses, fixes them up, and sells them to low-income buyers. Dillon says with all the foreclosures, prices have fallen as much as 50% in parts of Prince George's County. And yes, competition is fierce.
On the open market, we really don't have a ghost of a chance of acquiring any of these homes. We cannot compete with investors who are all cash offers who can close in a week or 2 weeks.
Dillon's organization is able to buy some houses through a federal program that gives them first dibs over private investors, but there are no such protections for the low-income buyers Dillon tries to help. She's seen people who've clawed back from foreclosure trying to buy a new house, but losing out to the flippers and their cash.
They lost their nest egg during the recession, and now that things are coming back and there's an opportunity to rebuild their wealth, they're losing out yet again.
But real estate professor Sanders says low-income homebuyers have a much better chance of lending a house in a place like Prince George's, where they're mainly competing against small flippers.
These are not the big operations that you find in Las Vegas and Phoenix, where they're going to the courthouse and buying up 20 properties, 30 properties, and flipping them over the course of a couple of months.
And driving prices up into the stratosphere. Sanders says if you live in a place dominated by small fry flippers, be thankful. It could be worse. In Prince George's County, Maryland, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
If you're a night owl on the West Coast, anyway, or a really, really, really early riser back east, the lunar eclipse tonight is apparently going to be really something. A blood moon is what it's called. It's going to be all crazy shades of orange and red. Green, though, is the lunar color associated with this next item. How, back in the 1960s, NASA convinced Americans to spend the money it would take to get to the moon and back. One word, you guys, marketing. David Meerman Scott and Richard Jurek, space aficionados and marketing professionals to boot, have a new book out about exactly that. It's called Marketing the Moon, the Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kai. Great to be here.
First question has to be, why did they have to market the moon? I mean, come on, it's like NASA and people love it and we're going to the moon.
Jeez, well, in the 1960s, it was just a radical idea. I mean, can you imagine deciding that we're going to send 12 people to the surface of the moon and that it's going to cost 4% of the national budget and 2% of the national workforce for a decade? We had to sell it.
Well, when you put it that way, I kind of get it. Who were they selling to, Rich?
Well, I think the main thing is that they were selling it not only to the American people but to the world. I mean, at the time, you have to remember that the Soviets were also involved in the space program. Their launch of Sputnik really pushed us into space in a big way. And the United States made the unique effort to do it as an open program. So both success and failure had happened at the same time. And so it was really the vanguard of real-time communication happening with, you know, the whole world watching.
Talk to me about television for a second, because we've all seen the footage, either those of us who remember it or those of us who've seen it on YouTube, of Walter Cronkite and all those network anchors. I mean, this was the, you know, some amazing percentage of televisions were tuned to CBS watching this thing. But that went on through the program, or at least through a good chunk of it.
Yeah, it did. It was live television, and the interest of the press was phenomenal. There were something like 3,500 press credentials issued for the Apollo 11 launch, and an equal number of people who were in Houston during the mission itself. And they loved to talk about this program. And many science reporters were focused on it, but then also human interest reporters and so on, talking about the space program.
So here's the cynical question, though, right? The cynical question is, how much did NASA play the American media? I mean, yes, it's a huge story, but come on.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call it playing the media. The brilliance of what NASA did at the beginning is they focused on what we would call today brand journalism and marketing speak. They hired a bunch of ex-journalists. They knew how to create content, not spin stories, not sell something in the traditional sell sense. So they were able to package the news, and I say that not in a pejorative sense, but in a real positive sense, in such a way that it could slip into the news stream of the day. And folks like Walter Cronkite and all the others in the media felt a kinship to that. They were speaking their language. So it really helped communicate to the world as opposed to just sell the story.
And the other aspect of that that fascinates me as a marketer is that Boeing and IBM and Raytheon and Omega watches and basically anything that was used in the space program had an interest in getting their little part of the story out. We have press kits from you know, people who made bolts.
and a word here about product placement. I think if you go out on the street today and say Tang to anybody, you know, 8 out of 10 people will say, oh, yeah, it's that orange drink stuff that the astronauts took to space, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, it was amazing how everyone wanted to be on the bandwagon. Stouffer's fed the astronauts.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
it may not have flown on the mission, but Stouffer's was served in the Manned Spacecraft Center, so it allowed them to market that they were feeding America's astronauts. So everybody got on board.
Here comes the forward-looking question then. America's space program, as you know, is in, I think, to be kind, we could say it's in a state of flux.
It's in a state of Earth orbit.
Earth orbit, that's right. Yeah,
shall
exactly.
we say.
Is there an amount of marketing that could be put together to convince America that going either back to the moon or to Mars or landing on an asteroid would have the same chance, odds of success, as did this Apollo effort?
Yeah, you know, from my perspective, the interest in space is really at a peak. You have movies like Gravity, you have The Rebirth of Cosmos as a television series. And, you know, it begs the question, are we going to spend our days playing with that technology in our pockets that's about 5 million times more powerful than the Apollo spacecraft, just playing Candy Crush? Or are we going to harness that power to solve the biggest problems of our time? And I think that's the legacy of Apollo, is our ability to achieve if we all focus on a common goal.
It is a book called Marketing the Moon, The Selling of the Apollo Lunar Program. It's by David Meerman Scott and Richard Jurek. Guys, thanks very much. I enjoyed the book.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A couple of final notes today, the first of which comes with the observation that prom season is almost upon us. Sadly, any conceivable connection to reality ends right about there. A florist in Louisville, Kentucky, is offering, I kid you not, a Kentucky Fried Chicken corsage. $20 plus shipping, baby's breath, the whole nine yards. You get yourself a $5 KFC gift certificate with it so you can customize the thing with original recipe or extra crispy. Only 100 available, kids. So act now. I don't know what matches which dress, by the way, that your date is going to be wearing. In more sane news, although arguably only slightly, This from the Marketplace desk of what could possibly go wrong. Google now has drones, and they are powered by the sun. The company that for some reason we all still call a search engine company has bought Titan Aerospace for an undisclosed sum. Titan's drones, we're told, the smaller of which has the wingspan of a Boeing 767, are designed to fly for years. Google's going to use them for mapping, of course, but also possibly as a high-altitude internet dispersal platforms. And there you go. That's it. Marketplace from APM on this Monday. The Dow hopped up 146 points today, closed at 16,173. NASDAQ lifted 22 points, 4,022 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 14 points, 1830 there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Tommy Andres, Millie Jefferson, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.